This is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor. Zorba here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. Want to talk with Zorba? Here's the number to call. 800-462-7413. Zorba, we always have some interesting research. What about this time?
Yes, we're going to talk about napping, the importance of napping in reducing your risk for a heart attack. Some interesting data out of the Archives of Internal Medicine. I'm a napper. Are you a napper, Tom?
Used to be, but I'm not anymore.
I am a napper.
I miss my naps, too.
I love it. Well, you'll have to capture them again and find them if you can. And what about transplants? Should they only be for the young? Should they be for the old? Some controversy, some ethical issues that essentially look at transplants.
They're
thinking
of redoing the kidney transplant.
That's right, kidney transplant issues. Very important issues.
How about our recipe?
Turkey, enchilada, lasagna. So we've got what we call a multicultural recipe. We've got the enchilada Hispanic side on one side, and we have the Italian side on the other side. And, of course, we have turkey, so that's low-fat Americana. How much multicultural can you get?
I'm skeptical. I like my recipes pure culture.
That's right.
I don't want my recipes mixed.
I'm sorry.
Culture.
It's a polyglot recipe, and that's what we have.
Enchilada, lasagna, I'm having a hard time coping.
And then you got the turkey, baby.
We have our medical mythbuster coming up, too. Again, our number, if you'd like to talk with Zorba, 1-800-462-7413. Zorba, a listener with us now in Boise, Idaho. Hi.
Hi there. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure. How can we help?
Well, the reason why I'm calling is I realize there are other much more serious medical conditions out there, but my whole life I've had to deal with the fact that I bruise very easily, and by easily I mean I could be just walking near a coffee table, accidentally bump the side of the table, and I'll have a bruise for 2 weeks. Someone might just jokingly kind of nudge me in the arm, and I'll have a bruise on my arm. My dog even, just jumping on my little 20-pound dog can jump on my lap, and I might get bruises on my legs. And I just am not sure if there's something I can take or if there's something I should do right after I feel that I might get bruised there. So I just thought I would call and see if you have any advice.
It's very interesting. When we look at bruising, there are a number of things that can increase your risk of bruising. So do you take aspirin every day?
No, I do not.
Okay, so a lot of people who take aspirin every day actually come into my office and they go, hey, I'm bruising. I've got this black and blue mark. Where did it come from? And the answer is it came from the aspirin. That's what aspirin does. Are you on steroids for any medical condition?
No.
No, and I kind of would have expected if you were that you would have said something because basically that's a heavy-duty drug. That leads to what's called capillary fragility, which can also lead to bruising. What happens when you cut yourself? Any problems when you cut yourself? Do you clot normally, or does it sort of seem to bleed forever?
No, I think I clot normally.
You would probably notice a difference. You know, if you were bleeding a lot, you would say, "Hey, I can never stop bleeding on a cut. If I've got to put pressure on it for a long period of time, because there are other genetic issues that can produce that. Serious diseases such as hemophilia, you would know about because it's also you wouldn't get hemophilia, but if you get it, it's called an X-linked disease, and you would know about that. Basically, some people simply bruise more than others. And the final common denominator for you is there's no explanation other than the fact that you bruise.
How about light-skinned redheads, blondes are more likely to bruise
I don't know if that's a situation.
Are you a blonde or a redhead?
I'm dark hair, kind of olive complected.
You see, it doesn't fit at all. Tom was ready to put you in the blonde hair, redhead, light-skinned, easily sunburned person.
I think she's lying to us just to make me wrong.
She's not lying to us. She's actually telling us the truth.
Picture.
Our people on the air don't lie. Public radio people never lie. They always tell the truth.
Okay, never
the
mind.
The whole truth
never
and nothing
mind
but
my
the
theory.
Truth. Only public radio.
There's no telling why some people bruise more than others, or
Just like some people hardly bruise. And no, at this point, I would say that's you.
Okay,
that's all
you.
I can say. Good luck and have a nice life.
Sorry, we couldn't help you with an answer.
You know, you can't help everybody. But sometimes you have an explanation, but sometimes I'm stumped. And that sort of stumped me. I'm sure we'll get some emails on people who bruise all of the time because there are bruisers out there who just are waiting to write us an email.
We'll find out. 800-462-7413, our toll-free number. Question for Zorba? Give us a call. To Notasoga, Alabama, we go now. Hi.
Hey, how are you both doing?
Fine. What's up?
I encountered a problem, I guess, in the last several years. Cramps when I was asleep at night in the legs, mostly. And they would be so painful that it would wake me. And so my daughter had suggested, she had the same thing. She suggested taking calcium, magnesium, and zinc. And so I tried it. I took two tablets. It seemed as soon as they hit my stomach, the cramp would go away. I'd get up and try to walk it off, but as soon as I took those tablets, the cramp would go away. And I'm kind of interested in how that works. I thought cramps were a result of muscle overuse, and how could you get a cramp when you're just laying it in the bed at night?
Now, the cramps you have are when you're trying to get to sleep. Is that what happens? Describe them. Kind of moving around with your legs, or they just hurt?
No, it's just I'm asleep. It's in the middle of the night, and they're so painful. I wake up, and of course I get up and try to walk them off first.
See, there are a couple of different things. There's restless legs where your legs are kind of moving around. It's described as restless leg syndrome. Your legs are moving around. And then there are night cramps, which can be a totally different thing, which can be a horse of a different color or similar to that, where people all of a sudden get a cramp in the middle of the night, a Charlie horse, the common term, and they have to get up and move around. The drug side of this, like I said, the Parkinson drugs do work, but really the other side of this is the way I recommend most people think about. And one of the things are using things such as vitamins and minerals, calcium, magnesium. People have used vitamin E. People have used a multivitamin that they take in the evening. They all say intermittently that these things will work. So I'm not convinced that they don't work, and I think you should continue with them. The other thing that people sometimes do is they'll take a hot bath before they go to sleep. They'll gently massage their legs before they go to sleep, or they'll walk around the block to try to exercise, or walk in their house in the wintertime when they can't walk around the block. And they avoid high-intensity exercise in the evening, which can also do this. But I think I'd stick with what you're doing. Hey, I think
there was a second part to the question. A side effect I wanted to declare from taking this combination of calcium, magnesium.
Yes, okay. What's your side effect?
It improves my memory.
Well, keep it up. Memory is something we always want to keep up, and if that supplement is helping your memory, go for it and stay with it.
There must be a lot of this restless leg syndrome going on because you turn on the TV, especially in the evening news time, and these drug companies are just
all over the place with restless leg syndrome drugs. Yeah, well, there are a couple reasons. Restless leg syndrome has been around for a long time. However, the FDA has only approved a drug for restless leg syndrome in the recent amounts, in other words, recent time.
Yeah.
So before that, you didn't see ads because there was no drug approved for it, even though these drugs were used. These Parkinson drugs have been used for about 5 to 10 years, but one drug, Requip, is the first drug that finally got approved for restless leg syndrome, and frankly, that's why you see it on television all the time. And I read a very interesting article the other day that after automobiles, drug companies are number two in advertising on the news. And they advertise on the news.
But you don't think that all these ads get people thinking they have this restless leg syndrome?
Well,
and they really
that's don't. Another question. Are they actually making a disease?
Right.
Well, the disease was there, and a lot of people had it, and they didn't know that there was something to treat it. So, but on the other hand, you could say they lived with it, and they didn't have to take another drug. So, that's a very interesting conversation, isn't it?
Well, speaking of sleeping, why don't we do the napping topic that you mentioned
earlier?
My
favorite. You're a napper. You said you're a napper.
I used to be.
Why'd you give it up?
Well, my lifestyle changed.
So now you don't need to nap.
No, I don't need to. Well, I would like to, but I just don't find the time. I'm so busy.
I'm so busy. I love napping. I find it very difficult to find the time to nap because I'm busy like everybody else. I want to get some stuff done around lunchtime. Yeah. I want to sit down and eat. And the fact is, napping may be good for us. And a recent article in the Archives of Internal Medicine shows that napping is good for us. Now, one of the issues is whether or not napping really reduces heart attack and stroke, or if it's just sort of a marker for physical activity and age and so on, because maybe a marker. So they went to Greece. Now, Greece has a lower incidence of heart attack and stroke than we do because they drink a little red wine, they have a little bit more olive oil, they smoke a little bit less than we do, they exercise clearly more because they walk 10,000 steps a day. That's what the average Greek man and woman does. So these were more than 20,000 Greeks, 20 to the age of 86, no history of heart disease when they started, no severe condition, followed for literally about 6-7 years, asked if they took midday naps during this time. Did you take a nap? How long? How many times a week? It's easy for people to look at it. They may be occasional nappers or never nappers and so on. Looked at the number who died of heart attacks, roughly about 800 died of heart attacks, and they found that men and women who took a nap, any kind of a nap, be it 10 minutes or 20 minutes or even as long as 30 minutes, had a 34% lower risk of dying from heart attack than those who did not take midday naps. We're looking at naps not at 5, but naps in the middle of the workday, midday naps. Systemic nappers who napped for about 30 minutes actually had a 37% lower risk of heart attack and stroke. This is an enormous difference for the nappers versus non-nappers. Well, when they looked at working men, they subgrouped out men who were working on jobs, because these were men and women who worked and didn't work. It was a 64% drop in heart attacks for men who worked for a living who napped for men who didn't nap.
Why?
I think what is happening is when you're napping, you're activating a similar system to when you're meditating. We know that people who meditate have less stress, or they're able to handle their stress in a different way. They're able to relax in a different way. And there may be something about taking that midtime day, shutting your eyes, shutting out the world, and giving yourself 15 or 20 minutes to regroup. Kind of regrouping. You're not doing anything. And in our hurly-burly, you know, society, we are always doing something 24-7. You know, just always doing something. And I'm as much of a problem as anybody else. The other day in the office, I was working to catch up because I had been on vacation, and I was working till 8 o'clock in the evening, answering emails and doing all sorts of stuff. And I thought, well, what am I doing to my body? I mean, I walked at lunch, but I'm working till 8 o'clock. The answer is we've got to take some time in the middle of the day where we don't do something, period. And a nap is a great way of doing that.
Absolutely.
And it may be, what I find interesting is, which is better for your heart, napping or exercising? I would love a head-to-head study, which I don't think will ever be done. You got the nappers on one side who don't exercise.
Yeah, that's interesting.
And you've got the joggers on the other side who exercise. Who gets more cardiovascular benefit, the nappers or the joggers? And my thought is that they both give benefit. You know, you feel better when you exercise. You're moving your body. There's some benefits to exercise. But wait a minute. There's some benefits to napping, too.
Sure.
And I think that it would be
They could do that study. They could do nappers, they could do joggers, and they could do both.
Interesting.
Yeah.
That's a good study. You need a lot of people to do it, and you'd have to tell the nappers you're not allowed to exercise.
Yeah.
And you have to tell the exercisers you're not allowed to nappers. I don't know if we'll ever see the study. Nonetheless, napping reduces the risk of a heart attack and stroke by 34 to 35%. That is as good as aspirin.
Okay, let's see if our producer has another call now. Adam, want to wake up now?
He's the napper.
Let's welcome that listener in Knoxville, Tennessee. Hi.
Hi there. Hi, Tom. Hi, Zorba. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. We appreciate your call. How can we help?
Well, I'm calling about vertigo, and I'm wondering if there's been any studies done or if you have any information on whether it's hereditary or not. And the reason I ask, my father's been treated for vertigo on several occasions, ranging from mild to pretty severe. And over the past couple of weeks, I've started feeling general dizziness when I wake up or at different parts of the day when, you know, I try to refocus or something like that. And I wondered if it's something I may have to look out for.
Yeah, I'm interested in Zorba's answer because I have the same situation. What kind of treatment did your dad get?
He was. I know it had to do with his inner ear, and I don't know specifically what treatment he underwent, but I know he ended up in the emergency room a couple times. They gave him some drops. They gave him some exercises to do where he'd, like, he'd kind of tip over and then sit back up and so forth. Mm-hmm. So
there's some those exercises are very interesting. They're called Appel's maneuvers, and they're a way of sort of trying to get it's very interesting. Let me go back a bit. In your skull, in your inner ear, you have a series of things called the semicircular canals and other apparatuses that are basically part of the inner ear that basically are responsible for balance. And there is a present theory that in one spot, one area, there are these little particles that are like sand, and they basically get into the wrong spot. And when they get into the wrong spot, the body thinks that you're dizzy. And so these maneuvers basically are to try to kind of push this sand, kind of flip it out of this fluid into another spot, and basically I'll get the sand out of there that's producing this abnormal sensation of the world is spinning. Mm-hmm. And for some people, this maneuver can be very, very effective. I think, Tom, you went and got trained in this maneuver once, didn't you?
Yeah, and it didn't seem to do me anything.
See, and so for other people, really it doesn't do anything. So it didn't do anything for Tom. Yeah. I've had people I've sent there, and about half the people say, yeah, I did this, and all of a sudden it went away, and other half people say they don't. It's not really hereditary. There's vertigo or dizziness can be caused by a whole bunch of things, from a tumor within the ear to a brain tumor to something called Meniere's disease, which can be associated with a really severe type of vertigo and spinning and produce lots of problems. And really, it can be a very serious problem. But it's not there are inherited forms, but they're very, very rare. Most people, it's a viral illness that simply gets better. Your dad's better or not better?
He got gradually better over the course of time. It took a while to kind of take, and then, you know, he would kind of get an onset of the dizziness again,
okay.
And then he'd get more treatment, and it would gradually go away.
Uh-huh.
So.
Okay.
But I didn't know, you know, if there was maybe something with my inner ear that would have been shaped like his, where that's something I'm going to have to, you know, take preventative measures something.
I'll tell you, vertical and dizziness and intermittent vertical is very, very common, especially as you get older. It's more and more common. Older people are more likely to have it. And it's kind of fascinating. When you're 10 or 11, you love it. You love the sensation of vertigo. When you're 5, you like to roll around, you know, and give yourself vertigo. You know, you spin around. Don't you remember as a kid? Little kid, you know, you'd go and spin around and make the world spinning,
yeah.
And you like that sensation. When you get older, you don't like that sensation.
It's awful when you're older.
It's
yeah.
awful. When you're younger, you like it.
Yeah.
You know, you go on roller coasters and things. In fact, you, as a young kid, you try to induce vertigo because it feels really good. And as an older person, you want to avoid vertigo because it's not. And I don't think anyone has ever come up with an instance of why people like it when they're younger and don't like it when they're older. Nonetheless, I think you're just fine. Chances are you're not going to get what your dad had, and so you can go through life knowing that you're probably not going to suffer like he did. So.
Okay, well, that's good news, because I have to admit, a couple weeks ago I did the spinning thing with my dog, so we'd both end up dizzy and, like, wandering around.
Did your
room,
did your dog like it when you did the spinning thing with your dog? I got a question for you.
Yeah, he seemed to enjoy it. It was good
you
bonding
did
time.
Did the spinning thing with your dog?
Wait a second.
Animal cruelty.
Wait a second. Were you holding
Not
the dog's hand?
PETA.
And kind
We're
of...
PETA when we need him.
Now, wait a minute. Was the dog throwing you around in a circle, or were you holding the dog in the paws and just spinning around, or did you get on a Ferris wheel? You were doing the spinning thing with your dog?
I pick him up, and then I just spin, and then, you know, it's
what,
just,
by the ears you'd pick him up?
By the ears!
Remember Lyndon Johnson did that with his dog?
No, I just told him. I pick him right up and just spin him, and then we just get dizzy and wander around.
Hey, you know, whatever turns you and your dog on, go for it. That's
yeah.
what I said.
Thanks for the call.
You know, we've got to start asking dog and pet questions more often. I think we'll find that there are people who do things with their animals that we don't even think about.
Zorba, our listeners are on your case again, and this time it's not a pronunciation thing.
Oh, great. It's not the grammar and the linguistic police.
A couple of weeks ago, you talked with a caller about her chronic headaches. She said that she was living on Excedrin. You told her to cut caffeine out of her daily regimen. But as a large number of our listeners were quick to point out,
right, Excedrin has caffeine.
Yeah, and I know
that's
you
right,
know that.
Right,
I guess
right,
we just
right.
didn't mention it. But
that's right.
It's not exactly the same. There can't be that much
well,
caffeine.
Well, no. First of all, there are some issues that are interesting with caffeine.
Yeah.
For many people, it's the amount of caffeine you're drinking or taking in. So in other words, it might be that 250 to 500 milligrams of caffeine a day is going to give you a headache, may give you the jitters, may give you the headache. For other people who are highly caffeine sensitive, they cannot have any caffeine at all. So if we look at Excedrin, and I don't know how many milligrams it is. I don't know if it's 25 or 32 or 50 milligrams. Mm-hmm. It's a small amount of caffeine, but it is in there. There's no doubt about it. For some people, they can take Excedrin, and that caffeine actually helps their headache and gets better, but they can't have a cup of coffee that might have, depending on how much you drink, 150 to 300 milligrams of caffeine. However, 25 to 50 milligrams of caffeine, not only do they tolerate, but it helps them. So our listeners are correct. Cutting caffeine out means also cutting the Excedrin out because Excedrin has caffeine in it. So they're correct in correcting me for that. Yes, I knew it, but I didn't mention it.
Yeah, but for some, I hear you saying, I think,
the
Excedrin is okay, but no added caffeine.
Absolutely. And I am one of these caffeine-sensitive people where I notice that during certain seasons of the year, specifically during the allergy season, if I drink too much coffee, 3 to 4 cups of coffee a day, which I can often do, that I will get a headache, and I drink 1 to 2, it doesn't bother me, and Excedrin is one of the things that I occasionally use for my headache. I use different over-the-counter medications to help my headache. So, thank you very much. You're right. Read those labels. That's the most important thing back. Read those labels, and thank you, listeners, for correcting me.
And send your comments, questions, and corrections to...
Zorba? Well, maybe I shouldn't give the email. Maybe that would be a better idea. Don't send your comments to zorba@wpr.org. No comments! No comments!
We have more of your calls coming up, and we have our recipe coming up next, your medical myth buster a little bit later. Lots of things going on here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Again, that toll-free number is 800-462-7413. A health question, a nutrition or diet question for Zorba, give us a call, 800-462-7413. Back to the phones after our recipe, but right now, Zorba, turkey enchilada lasagna is sitting right next to us
on the table here. It smells delicious. I think one of the things that's kind of neat about this recipe is, in America, we really have a combination of cultures. I mean, that's our strength, and that's what we've been, that's essentially American. And if I look at this recipe, we have ground turkey in it. Mm-hmm. That's what we do because we want to reduce fat. We have an enchilada, which is Hispanic, and we have lasagna, which is Italian. And I'm going to go through the recipe, and I'm going to comment also on things that we can do to even improve this recipe.
Okay.
We're always improving
okay.
things. So start out with 1 pound of lean ground turkey.
Pound of lean ground turkey.
Now, the importance here is that when you buy ground turkey, there's not one kind of ground turkey, like ground beef. Ground beef will say 85% lean, 90% lean. Obviously, the leaner it is, the less fat. If you have ground turkey, it usually has a lot of dark meat because white meat is a premium. That's what we eat often when we have deli meat, we eat deli white meat. So you want lean ground turkey because it will have more white meat. It might not be completely white meat, but it will have more, and that's
important. I always get ground turkey breast.
Ground turkey breast will be the leanest.
Yeah.
That's exactly it. 1 cup of chopped onions.
A cup of chopped onions.
Yes, sir. Delicious onions. I'd use regular Bermuda onions, yellow onions, nothing special.
Okay.
2 cloves of garlic finely chopped.
2 cloves of garlic finely chopped.
1/2 cup of your favorite enchilada sauce.
I didn't know they had enchilada sauce.
Well, how often do you shop in the grocery store looking in the Hispanic Mexican section?
Never.
That's it. Yeah. There you go.
But you just find enchilada sauce, and it has what in it?
E-N-C-H-I-L-A-D-A sauce. As long as you can read, which I can't do all the time.
Well, what kind of stuff is in there?
It's got some tomatoes in it. It has some spices in it. It often has some onions in it. It's the sauce that often goes on top of enchiladas when you're buying enchiladas in a restaurant.
Okay.
Okay. A corn tortillas, 10 6-inch corn tortillas cut in half.
10 6-inch corn tortillas cut in half.
That's right. 8 ounces of shredded cheddar cheese.
8 ounces of shredded cheddar cheese.
That's right, cheddar cheese. Now, when we look at a recipe, in this recipe, cheddar cheese will have the greatest amount of fat. So if you want to cut down on the fat even further, what you would use is low-fat cheddar cheese or no fat, and that will basically cut down the fat in this recipe.
But we're substituting then health for taste a little bit.
That's right. So you've got to make your decision, and it depends. When we look at this particular recipe, each enchilada is about 260 calories. So if we look at it from that point of view, if you want to have more enchiladas, then what you want to do is cut the fat out of the cheddar cheese and use no-fat or low-fat cheddar cheese.
Yeah.
Or jack cheese that might have a little less fat also. And 1/2 cup of green onions chopped.
1/2 cup of green onions chopped.
Here's how we make it. Preheat the oven at 375 when you're starting. Now, in a skillet, brown the turkey, garlic, and onion, and saute until the turkey is brown. Very important, it's got to be browned. No red in that turkey at all. Tom, I noticed that you're eyeing the recipe.
I think I'll bring it over here.
Add the enchilada sauce to the skillet, bring it to a boil, and then reduce the heat, cover, and simmer for 10 minutes, stirring occasionally. Now, grease a 9-inch baking dish. You can also use any one of the cooking sprays, the non-fat cooking sprays. Line half with the cut tortillas on the bottom. Top with the meat mixture and sprinkle the half with the cheese and then repeat with another layer. So basically you have the tortillas on the bottom. You've got the meat mixture, you've got cheese, then you've got then you basically have another layer of tortilla, meat mixture, and cheese. And then bake for 20 minutes in the oven, uncover and bake for an additional 5 minutes just to brown it off, and then top it at the very end with green onions and serve. And this smells absolutely delicious. I am ready to have this.
Adam was naughty this time. He put beef in here instead of the ground turkey. I can tell the difference.
Absolutely different.
It's very good.
Sometimes when he cooks, he doesn't have everything around the house, but this is great. Wonderful recipe.
But if I did the beef, if I was actually going to cook, which I wouldn't, but if I did the beef, it'd be a lot less healthy within that.
Well, okay. So let's say you're going to put beef in this instead of that. What you want to do then is you want to make sure that your cheese is low-fat or no-fat cheese. That's the issue. In other words, take from somewhere or another. In other words, if you're going to do it, if you're going to use a more of a saturated fat and an animal fat such as beef versus turkey, then you want to take that away from the dairy product and basically use a non-fat cheese. And that's kind of the way to massage any recipe. See where you can remove the fat and make a better fat. And better fats are fats that come from vegetables, the best fats essentially being safflower oil and olive oil.
That's very good. Would you like a copy of it? We're happy to send it to you. Address your request to Zorba Pastor on Your Health, 821 University Avenue, Madison, Wisconsin. Our zip code is 53706. Be sure to enclose that self-addressed stamped business-sized envelope.
Or, if you want to, you can go to our website at zorbapastor.org. You can pull down that recipe, or you can sign up for our weekly podcast and get that recipe and all the other recipes automatically when you plug it into iTunes.
+1 800 462 7413, our toll-free number. That's 800-462-7413. Zorba, let's see if we can help a listener now in Boise, Idaho. Hi.
Hello.
What's up?
I'm calling to ask. I have galactosemia. It's a rare genetic disorder. I lack the ability to digest milk products.
Okay.
I have managed to figure out how to substitute for different milk products and recipes. I use soy milk, and I use non-hydrogenated margarines. I also have used tofu before in some recipes, such as cheesecake. And I'm trying to find an alternative to use for condensed milk.
Clearly, because you can't digest dairy products, you've done a wonderful, masterful job. So the first thing I want to do is compliment you on using substitutes such as soy products, soy milk, and tofu, and basically these are all soy products, to be able to give that sort of rich, full feeling. Condensed milk, now that would be something that would be a little bit more difficult that I could imagine. But what I think I would do is I would start with soy. And what I would do with soy is I would gradually boil the water off of the soy, and I would keep it at a very loose boil, and I would boil it down, and I basically would make my own condensed milk out of soy milk. That's what I would do. And I would do it in a double boiler, because otherwise you're probably going to burn the bottom of the pan because of the proteins that essentially are, that are in the soy milk. And I would boil it down until you got it to the consistency that you wanted to. And then I would use that in the recipe. And you may have to sweeten it a little bit with sugar. I'm not sure how it will taste by comparison, but that's what I would use. So you're looking at using condensed milk in certain recipes. Is that what you want it for?
Yes, I've got a lot of cake recipes that call for condensed milk.
Uh-huh. You have a sweet tooth, huh? You like to bake?
Yes.
You like to bake. That's what I think I would do. What I would do is I would boil it down and I would experiment a bit. I don't know, and you'd have to go to, you'd have to Google this. That's what I would do to look at it. I would look at what is the consistency of milk. When they make condensed milk, basically they boiled it down, and I don't know if it's 25%, 50%, or 75% less water, but there basically is less water in condensed milk. And I think I would Google that. I'd write down condensed milk, consistency or water, and I would play around on the net until you find a website that gives the answer. I'm sure that one of our listeners out there in Radioland will give us the answer as to what it is. And then I would do it on a volume basis. So let's say, for instance, it is 50% less water. I'd put in a cup of soy milk, and I would boil it down in a double boiler until it was 50% less, and that's what I would use in the recipe.
Oh, that sounds great.
Yeah, that would be a way to derive that. But I want to just compliment you with galactosemia on essentially, finding ways to basically cook and be creative within the constructs of what your dietary constraints are. And I think that's wonderful.
I'm trying to get my taste buds around the idea of tofu cheesecake. Is it really good?
Oh, I bet it tastes good. How does it taste?
Good.
Yeah, I bet it tastes good. I think that would be...
It would be worth the taste.
Yeah,
it would
be worth the taste. It would be worth the taste. Send us the recipe for tofu. We're going to put our producer back on, Adam, and you send us a recipe for tofu cheesecake, and I will make tofu cheesecake one day, bring it to the station, and we'll see what Tom thinks about that.
Thanks a lot for the call. 1-800-462-7413, our toll-free number, 800-462-7413. Zorba, a listener with us now in St. Louis, Missouri. Hi.
Hello.
What's up?
Well, I was calling about some carpal tunnel symptoms in my right hand.
Mm-hmm.
And I was curious to know, I did have a nerve induction test. I am a full-time musician.
Mm-hmm.
And I was curious to know the therapies before committing to a surgery to treat carpal tunnel.
What do you play?
I play piano, keyboards, and out live I play acoustic and electric bass.
So this is a big issue as far as you're concerned, obviously.
It certainly is.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can just imagine that. Tell me about your symptoms. What sort of, when do you get them? What brings them on? What makes them better? What makes them worse?
Well, last fall, I was on a job, and I was starting to experience like electric type of shocks going through my right hand, mostly like through my palm area. Like I couldn't almost finish the job. When I had my nerve induction test, they did say that I had, the numbers showed symptoms of a carpal tunnel, pressure on that. I did have a cortisone shot in my wrist.
Okay, that's good, by the way, because that is one thing that you can do for carpal tunnel syndrome. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't work. What happened after you had that injection?
Well, it seems to be doing pretty well. I haven't had the crippling pain that I had on that one job, but the doctor was like, well, this might take, and if it doesn't, here's your only other option. So I was just curious to know what.
How much time you spend on the computer?
I do a lot of audio editing.
Use a mouse a lot?
Yes, I sure do.
Uh-huh. You have a little pad, a little gel pad?
I have a pad for my keyboard, not necessarily for the mouse.
I would recommend that. I'll tell you, that's a big issue because that's probably a chief cause of a lot of carpal tunnel syndrome. What you want to do is get these, they're pads. They come in a whole variety of ways. They come in little square pads. They come in long pads along the bottom of the keyboard.
Right. How do you like the trackballs? Is that...
Trackballs are great.
Okay.
Trackballs are great. Ergonomic keyboards that open up so your hands are not flat. If you put both hands flat on the surface on the ergonomic keyboard, you can actually manipulate them so they're almost facing one another,
Oh, okay.
Almost like playing an accordion. if you picture that.
Right.
Those keyboards can be very effective in people because instead of putting your hands down, you're putting your hands to the side. They really work well for carpal tunnel. If you're a musician, you'll have no trouble adapting to that other keyboard. Anything you can do to get rid of the pressure will work.
What are your thoughts on acupuncture and stuff like that?
May work. Acupuncture works for, you know, just like the cortisone shot that may work. There's some exercises that some people recommend. I haven't seen much. If you look in the complementary and alternative literature, they talk about B vitamins, especially B6 and B12, but there were some double-blind studies that show that they didn't make any difference at all. I used to recommend pyridoxine phosphate, but the studies have shown they really don't, it really doesn't do much. So I've given up vitamins. I'm really more on the mechanical issues of why it's caused, and it's really caused by sitting at the computer. Carpal tunnel has been a dramatic increase since we've become a computer nation.
But he's a keyboard guy. That has
no, it's not just the keyboard. It's the computer. It's the pressure on there. When he plays keyboards, your hands are not there. They're moving around more, right?
Right. I spend a lot of time editing on a workstation, you know, like a typical computer.
It's not playing, it's not playing the keyboard because your hands are above it
right.
and you're moving around. It's that you are resting your hands on there. And when I took typing back in the dark ages, when we had a manual typewriter, you had to keep your – you didn't have carpal tunnel because you had to use your whole arm to sort of push down the keys. Now, you know, with a computer, I rest my – and I've got a little carpal tunnel in one hand. The one hand I had surgery in, I rest my hands on my gel pad, and now I don't need surgery on my other hand. So gel pad, trackball, ergonomic keyboard.
So and finally, what are your thoughts on surgery, if it comes to that?
Oh, I think surgery, it's 95% effective in the right hands, and the right hands mean you want to have a minimal scar.
Right.
You want to have it done by somebody who does lots of them. So those are a number of people do them. Neurosurgeons do them. You know, it depends. Some do more than others. Some like them. Hand surgeons do them. Orthopedic surgeons do them. But the real issue is you want to make sure the scar, which is basically at the base of the hand where the hand and the wrist starts, is no more than a quarter of an inch to a half inch. I have one on my right side. You cannot see my scar unless you actually look for it. And that's because I chose the right person.
Yeah.
So.
Thanks.
Good luck.
Call. Appreciate it. 800-462-7413, our toll-free number. Time now for a question from the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox. This one comes to us from Judith in Buffalo, New York. She writes, I've noticed that certain foods high in cholesterol stick to silverware and plates. You really have to scrub to get them off. For example, try washing a knife used for spreading cream cheese or a plate with fried egg on it. So, could this be a new way to identify foods high in cholesterol if they stick to your plate?
No, I don't think so. Not at all. Sticking to the plate, a lot of things will stick to the plate
like?
That are not necessary. Well, proteins tend to stick to a plate. So, I mean, basically, you're looking at protein foods that are not necessarily high.
Such as?
Yeah, I don't think you can say that.
Examples, please.
Okay, an example would be if you put lasagna in the oven, which is not a high-fat food, and you burn it, it'll stick to the plate. It'll stick to the pan. So you've got lasagna. A lot of things will stick to the pan. You know, burnt tomato sauce sticks to a pan and is difficult to get off. So I don't think it would be
Doesn't work, I don't think
it would be a consistent way of looking at it. You can burn a lot of things on a pan, certainly in the oven, in a plate, and they don't necessarily stick. But proteins do tend to stick to that. So
That's
it's kind of interesting. So there may be a tendency, but I don't think you can
But
say
not
that
a hard and
doesn't.
Fast rule.
Not a hard and fast rule.
Well, we like hearing from you. Just send us your comments, questions, and tips to
Zorba@WPR.org.
So, stick around. Lots more coming up, including our medical myth buster, more health news, more of your calls, too, on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. From PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. 800-462-7413 if you'd like to talk with Zorba. But now, Zorba, time for what I think is an interesting little controversy here, maybe big controversy, especially for those in need. The Organ Procurement and Transplantation Network thinking about redoing its standards on who gets kidneys.
Right. At this particular time, the person who gets the kidneys basically is the person who's the sickest, the most ill. And the real issue is whether or not that should be altered. In other words, age, should that play a difference? So, for instance, let's say you have a 40-year-old dad, a father of young children needs a kidney versus, we'll say, a 70-year-old dad whose children are out of the house. You know, you've got a difference in life going on forward. In other words, the 40-year-old is clearly has a longer life expectancy than the somebody who's 70. Yeah. Does that play a role?
This is really a kind of 180-degree flip here because we're going from the person who's most in need to the person who the kidney would last longest in.
Right. And it's a very, very, this is a very difficult ethical issue that clearly we have to answer because you might have somebody, a good example would be for livers, for instance. You have somebody who has a cirrhosis and they got it from alcohol and they stopped drinking 10 years ago. Okay. So they're not an alcoholic. We don't have at this time, they are an alcoholic recovering, but you know, they haven't drank for 10 years, so we know they're okay.
Yeah.
They have a liver transplant. And then you've got somebody with biliary atresia, somebody who's got needs a liver transplant, they have cirrhosis, but it's not from alcohol. Okay, so they got it because they got a disease that produced cirrhosis. They're both getting up for a liver. There's only one liver available. Who gets it?
Well, these standards, though, wouldn't take that into consideration.
No, and you've got one person who, say, is a younger person, is an alcoholic, and you've got the older person maybe has a 5-year life expectancy or a 10, and the younger person might have a 30-year life expectancy. Should age play a role on who gets it? Now, with kidneys, you can say, well, then you can do dialysis, but dialysis is a tough road to hoe.
Dialysis is a huge lifestyle change.
It's a big lifestyle change, so you can't just say, well, the old guy can be on dialysis.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, you've got a young person who may be active in life with children. You know, what would you do?
I don't have a clue as to what the answer would be. Now, we should point out this is only for kidneys from
cadavers. And the kidneys from cadavers, and they're looking actually at the state of Oregon that's grappling with these rules. But these rules are important rules for us as a society to answer.
But now, if I needed a kidney and you were a match, you would give me a kidney.
Oh, would I give you a kidney? Yeah. I probably would give you. I might give you a kidney, sure. Yeah.
I wish I had a lie detector on you.
But if you were a relative, I would definitely do a kidney. But I might do it for a close friend. Yeah, that might be the answer. But these are society issues, tough to solve. Stay tuned.
800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. 1-800-462-7413. A listener in Springfield, Missouri with us now. Hi. What's up?
Well, I'm having kind of a rather gross medical problem. a couple years ago, I started coughing up these little nodules. If you think about what a brain looks like, how they have all the little pieces on them, they look like little brain pieces. It's just very, I know.
Wait a minute. Weird. This is like a cat hacking up stuff?
Well, there's not like anything connected to it. They're just these little yellow pieces, and they range in sizes from about the size of my pinky nail to they could be much smaller. And they smell really bad. And I've tried to keep one before to take to the doctor to get it tested, and they shrivel up and just kind of turn into this icky little mess. So I can't even keep them to take to the doctor.
This isn't something recent, so we could link it to something you ate, or is it?
No, it's just been happening for the past couple of years.
Oh.
So let me get this straight. So you're coughing up, this is from your lungs, or this is from your throat, or?
I'm not quite sure. They start, like, because I cough, and that's how I get them out.
Mm-hmm.
I can feel it start tickling in my throat.
Okay.
And then I cough, and it comes out. So I don't even know where it's coming from, if it's coming from my, I've heard so many weird places that it could come from different people.
Well, it is important, by the way, if you ever have something that you're coughing up that you're concerned about it, you put it into a clean cup. You can actually get a specimen cup from your doctor. You know, you call your doctor up and say, I'm coughing the stuff up, I want to bring it in. They'll give you a sterile specimen cup, and you cough it into there. And the reason it's shriveling is it's then dehydrating. Whatever you have, whatever's coming up, which may be little plugs of mucus, are then dehydrating, and because so they're becoming becoming sticky, yucky little things.
Mm-hmm.
But you do want to cough them up, bring them to the doctor, have your doctor look at it under the scope, and she or he can tell you what they may be. They're probably, especially if they smell, these may be, there are things called crypts, which are in the back of your tonsils. And sometimes these crypts will either become a repository for mucus that dries up in it, and when it comes out, it smells, and it's awful. And some people actually brush their tonsils to get rid of these things, and they're awful. Other people use water picks, and still other people actually pick them out. Mm. And these can be very smelly little things that basically dry up and stick to the tonsils. And that could be what this is from. On the other end, it could be from your lungs. And basically, it's a matter of looking at under the microscope to see if there are any white cells, which would imply that there's pus and there's an infection going on. You got to capture them. You got to cough it up into a container.
Is this something to worry about?
Well, she's been doing this for years, and how's your health?
Well, it's okay. Actually, the reason why I'm asking about it is I haven't had the problem in about a month.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But whenever about a year ago, I started running, every time I'd run, mm-hmm. I would start coughing them up, yeah. So I quit running.
So you
but
quit
now
running.
I'm kind of overweight, and mm-hmm. I'd like to start running again,
yeah. Do you
but
have
I'm afraid it's going to happen.
Do you have any asthma at all? Any history of asthma?
I don't think so.
Okay. Get a specimen container from your doctor, or as the alternative, go buy some baby food, wash it out in the dishwasher or whatever, and then boil it in water, and that will work as a specimen container too.
Okay.
And bring that into your doctor, have them look at it under the scope and say what's going on. Have your doc look back in your tonsils to see if these are coming from your tonsils, because you want to know where they're coming from. I mean, you know, if you're coughing up yucky, yellow, smelly, stinky things, I think you need to know what they are so that you can at least identify what those yellow, yucky, smelly, stinky things are.
Okay.
Appreciate the call. 800-462-7413. We take a moment now, Zorba, for our medical myth buster. And today's myth will concern all of our veggie lover listeners and rabbits. Do carrots really improve your eyesight?
Well, it does for the rabbits. That's right, the rabbits.
What's up, Doc?
Well, that's very good. You know, your mom is probably the one that told you, you know, you got to eat your carrots. They're good for your eyesight. But frankly, it's because carrots contain beta carotene. That's a component of vitamin A.
Yeah.
And for people who are vitamin A deficient, yes, they're very important for your eyesight because otherwise you can't have night vision. But in our society, it's not an issue because we get vitamin A from a variety of sources. It's really an issue in areas where rice is the staple that you eat, especially polished rice, which is white rice, and basically you're not getting any beta carotene because you don't have beta carotene from vegetables, which is what we get them from. We basically get it from vegetables. So there are studies years ago. South Asia, it's a big issue, especially in poor areas such as Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, and they took 30,000 women in South Asia who were at high risk for vitamin deficiency. They gave them vitamin A tablets and basically cut down night blindness by nearly two-thirds because they did not have enough vitamin A. But in our society, you eat your fruits, you eat your veggies, we don't see vitamin A deficiency. I mean, I've never heard of a case in the total time that I've been a doctor, and that's been a few years, of vitamin A deficiency ever existing anywhere, certainly in the U.S., unless you're in an area of high poverty where you're only eating rice. That's basically what you're eating.
And if I'm getting enough, it won't help me any to eat a lot of carrots to improve my eyesight.
Well, that's the issue. The issue is if you have poor eyesight, will eating carrots improve your eyesight? And the answer is that's a myth. The only way it improves your eyesight is if you're vitamin A deficient.
Yeah.
If you take a multivitamin, by the way, you never have to worry about it because there's enough vitamin A in that. But eating your carrots is good for your body. It reduces colon cancer. It's good fiber. It's probably good for your heart. But it has nothing whatsoever to do with improving your eyesight. And there was a study that was done out of Harvard to see whether or not beta-carotene would reduce the incidence of cataracts because that was the theory. Mm-hmm. And they found that beta-carotene pills taken by people for 12 years did not affect cataracts at all.
Mm-hmm. Well, send us a MythBuster you'd like us to bust. Just send it in an email with the subject titled MythBuster. Make sure to send that email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Our phone number here is 800-462-7413. And Zorba, our next caller is in Lafayette, Indiana. Hi.
Hi, how you guys doing?
Fine. How can we help?
Well, I'm a college student here at Purdue, mm-hmm. and basically my question is regarding tap water. I drink probably about six glasses a day, and I guess the reason just being that the water that comes from the tap is free as opposed to paying for it at the store.
Sure.
But anyway, I drink about 6 glasses a day, and I want to know if I'm doing myself really a disservice.
Not at all. You are doing yourself a service because you're saving money. And I think, and it's very interesting, I think one of the biggest scams, and I'm right on the same scam business ex Consumer Reports, that has occurred over the last few years is that the bottling companies have convinced us that tap water isn't very good and we should drink bottled water. And in our society, tap water is just fine. It is not a problem. Now, some people, first of all, the safety of tap water is unparalleled. Potable water, drinkable water in our society is regulated by the feds. It's regulated by the state. It's totally safe. The issue is tap water contains fluoride in some areas. And some people say, well, I don't want to take fluoride because it's a big issue, although fluoride has dropped the number of dental caries, in other words, cavities, by about 80%. There's a small group of people who think, well, fluoride is bad for you, and we know that in the amounts that are put in tap water, it's not. So you are doing yourself a service as a college student by drinking tap water. Save your money, and then you can spend it on something else that is more worthwhile.
Well, our caller is a college student.
He's a college student, that's right.
Should we
know what life is like. Lots of money.
Should we talk about the issue of tap beer as opposed to bottled beer?
Tap beer in terms of tap water? I think that's another topic. We're not going to discuss tap beer versus tap water. We're going to keep it just on tap water. That's very good. But tap beer costs money, you see. He's saving money
with
this.
That's the truth.
Thanks. Keep up the water. How do you like college? What year are you in college?
I'm a sophomore now, and so far so good.
Uh-huh.
Thank you guys so much.
Thank you. Thanks for listening
to
Public Radio.
Not long ago, Zorba, we were helping an emailer with her question about traveling abroad in India. She wanted to know if toilet seat covers would be useful, and you said they wouldn't. Turns out you were more right than you thought, or at least more right than you indicated. Gwen in Joplin, Missouri, who sent us more information than we wanted to know about foreign toilets, writes, "The reason toilet seat covers serve no purpose in India is that there are no toilet seats. The exception is if you stay in a hotel designed for Westerners."
Oh, she's talking about the squat toilets of India. She's exactly right. I hadn't really even thought about that. That's right. I've been to India. That's right. There is no toilet seat. It's a squat toilet. That's exactly right. Right.
So that's the totality of your reaction.
Thank you. That's right. I've been actually the image of the squat toilets are coming back into my mind. I just pictured the squat toilet in northern India. That's exactly it. And I was thinking about how nice it was to get back to the western toilets.
Gwen,
thank you.
Thanks, I guess. And to the rest of you who emailed us, keep those emails coming. Send your comments, questions, and tips to
Zorba@WPR.org.
For a copy of this week's recipe and all things Zorba, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org.
And don't forget, you can call our producer anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio, and our executive producer is Charles Monroe Kane. Brad Kohlberg and Adam Friedrich are our peanut gallery. Gigi Holland makes sure you get your recipes. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, hoping you'll join us for the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
For a copy of today's show, call the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0224Z. To buy Zorba's book, The Longevity Code, Your Personal Prescription for a Longer, Sweeter Life, or to pick up a copy of Zorba's Heart Healthy Cookbook, just go to our website at zorbapastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.